Hi, and welcome to The Return, Property and Investment Podcast. I'm Anna, and in this episode, we're talking hot trends and opportunities in the market, how technology can help investors make better decisions, and using theory to make better predictions and create real opportunities for profit with Andrew Bourne, Oxford and Cambridge professor and multi-million pound business owner. So I'm going to let him introduce himself because there's a whole long list of credentials and I think it's worth getting into the detail from you directly. Talk to me about what you've done and are doing, Andrew.
Okay, Anna. And thanks for asking me onto this podcast. So I've been splitting my working life between university teaching, research and business since about 1992, something like that, when I sold a business to Henderson and had to therefore reduce my academic workload down to one day a week. And ever since then, I've realized that it suits me very much to be partly in the university and partly in the business world. And I think the business world helps me be a more interesting teacher, but it also the academic world helps me organize my thoughts better. So it makes me a better advisor. So that's the sort of the place I've been in for a long time, and I suspect I'll always be. It's also helped me to develop a few principles, which we'll talk about in the podcast. Right now, where I've ended up is I've got three main jobs or responsibilities. One is running the real estate initiative at Oxford University in the Said Business School. That involves teaching MBA students, EMBA students and executives, but also running a research program on the future of real estate, which is technology driven. So we've got three researchers and a four-year research program funded by a lot of businesses, Ernst & Young, UBS, CBRE, Redevco, and so on. So that's one part of my world at the moment, which is research-driven and education-based. The second thing I do is run my own consulting business called Property Funds Research, which started out life as a pure research business. It was actually a prop tech business from the first wave. So we created an internet-delivered data tool to help people map the world of unlisted property funds, institutional investment. And we then spun off a funds of funds manager from that business. And that was bought by CBRE Global Investors in 2006. That's now called CBRE Global Investment Partners. And it's managing, I don't know, $25 billion. It's been incredibly successful and remains successful. It's just won the biggest mandate ever given to any manager in the real estate world of about $5 billion from the Japanese government. So that business has gone pretty well. And I now run a small business which is doing similar things with smaller cap lumps of money. So we have small institutional investors and family offices as our clients. And then the third thing I do is I chair a business called Newcore Capital Management, which was set up by my former student, Hugo Llewellyn, in 2011. And I've chaired the business right from the start, and Hugo's been the CEO from the start. We're now raising our fourth fund, and we're going to be up to 100 million, and it's an institutional fund for the first time this time. So they're my three main responsibilities. I'm very lucky to be connected with a few other organisations that asked me to be an advisor, and most of my knowledge comes from them. So happy to crack on.
Okay, so that's fantastic. One of the things you mentioned was that there's some fundamental values that underpin everything you do. And I'm in complete agreement with you on the value in the intersection between understanding and knowledge and actually making money and achieving more through investment or any field. Talk to me about the values that underpin what you do across those.
Okay, there's a social value, which is a concern that the global financial crisis revealed some evils in the financial management industry that I absolutely don't want to be part of. And that comes down to excessive pay, excessive bonuses, carried interest, a distortion of the value of investments away from people who aren't able to look after themselves, pensioners specifically, and putting money in the pockets of people who are able to look after themselves. And we are going to suffer badly from that through political reactions such as the Brexit vote and Trump's mm-hmm. election and things like that. So that's number one, is that as professionals in investment, we have a responsibility to think a bit more about the social impact of what we do. And that can take a variety of forms. But being seen as a greedy, avaricious property developer is not something I want to be connected with. So that's number one. Then the other principles that I've learned are to do with investing. It's about how do you do well as a property investor on behalf of your clients or yourself. And they basically flow from academic life. I mean, they flow from a belief in the fundamental principles of finance, one of which is that markets are, you should assume that markets are generally efficient. and therefore there are very few free lunches lying around. And that leads on to a lot of views, one of which is that speculative development to sell is a very, very risky thing to do. And it's not something I'd ever want to put a lot of money into myself, because frankly, it's like gambling. I mean, it's gambling. You are putting money into a manufacturing process that you often can't control, because the construction company that's working for you isn't under your control directly. Mm-hmm. And the exit is not under your control either. So you probably got it financed in order that you have to sell it as soon as it's finished. And then you can't control what the market's like at that point in the future. So residential property development to sell is even worse, because you're then at the mercy of people who aren't necessarily making rational decisions. So if the flavour of the month has gone against price rises in the resi market, which is where exactly we are now, then, you know, I wouldn't want now to be bringing out a load of residential developments to sell into the London market.
Not a great time.
But when I started 3 or 4 years ago, it probably looked okay. So I think it's a classic example. So that's the second principle. And then the third one, and the fourth one, and the fifth one all flow from that. One is about value investing. So
talk me through that.
Okay, so there are two different interpretations of value investing. One is banal. One is a really banal interpretation of value investing, which is that you buy things that are worth more than you're paying for them. And that's the sort of Warren Buffett. Mm. And it's completely sensible, but it's banal, because obviously, if you're an academic or if you've ever studied finance, you know that you're supposed to be buying things that are NPV positive, so that are value investing. So as long as you're paying less than you think the fundamental value of the building is, then that's value investing. A slightly more nuanced interpretive valuation of value investing for property is that you favour assets that are slightly higher yielding and that probably have lower rents than you think are possible. So we run a system in PFR where we try to find assets where the cap rate is higher than you'd expect it to be and where the rental value is lower than you'd expect it to be. And the last point is very rarely done in the property market. People do not measure what they think the rent ought to be. So if you ask somebody, what should the rent be in West End office market right now? There are very few models out there that will tell you what it is. They'll tell you what it's been. Mm-hmm. They'll tell you what their rent growth forecast is, but there's no fundamental perception of, if Paris is at £50 a square foot a year, if you measured it that way, London should be at 75, 50% more. So we run models that are based on that. And when you put the rent and the cap rate together, you end up with a price per square foot. So we can say what we think the right price per square foot for an office building in Reading is right now, and we would buy it for less than that. So that's value investing. And the last one I think that is probably worth getting out of the way now is options. It's to do with options. So the secret to wealth and good property investment is to engineer call options, which means buy assets that have got a good existing use value, which is what you're paying for, but which have alternative use value, which you're not paying for, mm-hmm. and give you a series of upside options that are not balanced by any downside risk.
Okay. So multiple exit strategies,
right? Yeah. Planning strategies, change of use strategies, all sorts of different things that you can do. And the nicest one to buy is bare land that's rented out, you know, because you've got your downside covered. The existing use value is clearly given by the rent that you're being paid for storage, for example. But all of the options are there to build on it, change the use of it. Mm,
interesting. Okay. So they all seem like very sensible theories.
Not theories, Anna.
What are they? Principles.
Principles. They may be based in theories.
Okay, yeah, they are principles. I'm with you. So some of the stuff that you've looked at over the years has been quite theoretical, right? And I guess these principles are your way of translating that into practical, tactical, implementable ideas. But theories don't always translate directly into something that you can implement, something you can invest in, and a profit opportunity. So how do you go sort of from, let's say, the idea of, well, you talked about the income-led value investing, maybe one of the other ideas that you've discussed, how do you go about implementing that to make a profit, make a better investment decision?
Okay, well, all of the whole value investing principle is founded on an investment theory. And the investment theory is that the price of a piece of real estate, if you just focus on the cap rate for now, forget the rent. So if you focus on the capital markets, if you focus on the cap rate, then I have a model for explaining cap rates, which I have used for 30 years and which I believe is as sound as any model can be. Mm. And it relates the cap rate to a risk-free rate a risk premium and the expected rent growth that I can get out of the building. That means that I have a fundamental model which drives pretty much everything that we look at. And it answers questions like, you know, what is your perception of the bond market and what that's going to do to property prices? Because in my model, there is a pretty clear connection, and I know exactly how that connection works. And therefore, we can monitor what's going on in the bond market, and we've probably got 9 months' notice of what's going to happen in the property market.
Interesting. Okay, and then how do you use that? Of course, you change your investment decisions. Your clients, for example, the advisory business, are typically very large scale investors, and you would provide advice. So how do you change what you would advise them to do, or you just, what's the process there? So to translating that insight into something that can make profit.
Okay, well, if right now the US bond yield curve has lifted about 1% in the last year. So right across the short bond to the long bond, everything's gone up 1%.
Okay.
The US is probably a leader in the global bond market. And for at least 9 years, Oxford Economics have been forecasting a rise in UK bond yields, and they've been wrong. Now, there's only so long that they can be wrong, because there's probably going to be a rise in bond yields at some point. The issue is simply, you know, how much and when. Now, if the US yield curve has lifted 1%, which is a lot, in 1 year, then that suggests to me that there is pressure on UK bond yields upwards. That's also mirrored in the correction in the stock market. Our own bond yields are creeping up a little bit. Our inflation expectations are creeping up. They feed into the bond yield as well, all part of this model. So all the models tell me that this is a time when property yields are going to go up. Everything says that.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice to property investors right now is to be very careful about investing in core real estate at sharp yields, because those yields are probably going to move up.
So by which you mean there's a price correction and therefore your yield goes up?
Yeah. Well, the yield going up forces the price correction, because the multiplier of rent goes down.
Mm.
And where that's going to hit hardest is probably the long lease, very long lease assets that are like bonds, you know, the ones that people are buying as bond substitutes. The protection we've got in the system is that there's a bit of a premium, a bit of wriggle room for bond yields to rise before property markets really react. But 1% is quite a big move in the US. And if that continues up, then we're moving for definitely a falling capital value market. So where would you put your money? You put your money into things where there is a supply-demand imbalance. So where is there a shortage of supply and a fundamental demand? And that is rental housing, social infrastructure, schools, hospitals, to a lesser extent student housing, which is probably, you know, the supply is catching up with the demand. But there are pockets, storage space, logistics space, you know, all of those fundamentals are pretty undersupplied. So that's a market to look at. And we've not had a lot of development finance available either. So there's been a reasonable amount of discipline in the lending markets, which means we don't have a massive oversupply of space.
Interesting. So a big issue, I suppose, is you said earlier that you felt that markets were inherently broadly perfect, which I disagree.
Efficient.
Okay, but that is the definition of a perfect market.
Yeah.
I find that really hard to agree with in the direct property investment space, but obviously most of your focus really is in the indirect side of things, so investing via a vehicle, right? Rather than investing in, let's say, a block of flats, you'd invest in a company that invests in a block of flats.
Yeah, no, I'm much happier talking at the strategic level, the big picture level, the fund level, than I am at the individual asset level. We could debate for a long time about whether the property market is efficient at the individual asset level, and it probably isn't through information mismatches and I can absolutely see how you can buy buildings and make money out of them. It's much harder to make money out of big assets that are very well marketed. It's the smaller end of the market, it's easier. So yes, there's probably less perfection in the bottom, smaller end of the market.
Or the direct end, exactly.
I think the market for the cheese grater is as efficient as you can possibly get. So that's a direct asset. Mm-hmm. But a small piece of real estate in Norwich, maybe not.
Mm. And you feel that's based on information, access to information. So I think that one of the big changes that's affected information is obviously technology. And I technology impacted the market in more ways than one. In your field, or in your niche, how has technology changed property investment, and in terms of creating opportunities or creating threats? Or
not in the slightest.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Interesting. Not even on the understanding piece?
Really? I know you want to come up with a positive answer. I think it will.
Yeah.
I think it will, but no, I mean, the property market is incredibly unaffected by all this. The first sign of technology affecting the real estate market has been the decline of the retail sector and the growth of Amazon and the popularity of logistics. So that is an example of it. But if you're talking about how has technology changed my day-to-day business, the answer is hardly at all. And in the world of property fund management, the institutional end of it, there are two processes going on all the time. One is distribution, raising capital, and the other is manufacturing, buying the buildings and putting the funds together. And technology has hardly impacted either of those things. Now, I've spoke to a chap called Keith Breslauer, who runs Patron Capital, who raised his fourth fund about a year and a half ago, and he raised about $900 million for a value-add Europe fund. And he kept a record of all the meetings he'd had to raise the capital. And he'd had 497 meetings to raise his $900 million. Now, no human being can go through that more than twice. If you've done a capital raise with 497 meetings over this period of 18 months, and then you've got to invest the money, as soon as you're investing the money, you're on the road again, raising the next fund, because that's the way the economics of these things works. You cannot do it. It's just physically impossible. You're going to die. And recently, there's been a lot of signs that people have been selling their businesses because they're just fatigued. You know, they've Brockton Capital sold a chunk of their money to an Israeli investor because they just don't think they can stomach getting out on the road again, doing it all and all over again. So why aren't we using technology? And the technology is there for anything else. It's there for dating, you know. Why isn't it there for matching investors with assets or funds?
Interesting.
So that's one example. Then the manufacturing process, how do you find assets? Is that, you know, you bought buildings. Do you use technology to find buildings?
Well, to an extent, I definitely use it in the due diligence process.
That's different.
Is it?
Finding them in the first place.
Ah, okay. No, I don't personally, but I know others who do.
You do?
Yes, personally, I think you can get leads via technological sort of channels, but ultimately I think property is very relationship driven at the level that I operate at. So again, it's that getting on the road thing. I don't know that you can substitute that with technology. Before we started the recording, we were talking about AI and how it might help or not help with some of the more laborious tasks in businesses. But I don't think we're quite there yet with replacing ourselves in that.
I think it will start to change things though. So we've invested in a business called Source Central, which is trying to bring GPs and LPs together through an app. We certainly think that more and more data will become available on buildings.
So who would use that app and how?
Well, if you were a middle-sized institutional investor, let's say in a US state pension fund, Ohio State pension fund, and you had a limited budget and you knew that you wanted to put some money in Europe, then the app would be extremely useful for you to connect with GPs who are launching funds in Europe so that you knew that you'd got the playing field covered. And even if you didn't use the app to decide to invest in something, you'd know that you could do a report about all of the funds that are out there. Mm-hmm. So if you decided to go into Brookfield 6, at least you've done the due diligence on looking at the alternatives. It's also a medium for the fund managers to pitch to the GPs without having to fly to Ohio. And this 497 meetings, 20 of which were in Korea, by the way, you know, you physically can't do that. So there's got to be tremendous efficiency in putting your goods in front of people. It won't mean that you never meet them. You absolutely will. You still meet those investors a couple of times to get them over the line. But you know, why would you introduce your fund to them that way?
Intro can be done on a video, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So efficiency gains to come, but essentially you don't feel that technology has really changed any aspects of your
Not business. Yet, no.
Interesting.
We're all jockeying for position. And the data thing is probably the biggest one where you know, we're all thinking about what data we've got, how we can use it to make better decisions. But really, we're still practicing that.
So you hear about kind of algorithm driven exchange traded funds, which are able to do the job that you would have done as a person, and people being replaced in kind of trading context.
Definitely.
As well.
Yeah.
So it is having an impact, but
on investment.
Not really on the principles. guess what you're saying.
Well, I think it's had an impact on securities funds. Definitely. So the question then arises, will real estate ever be able to operate as if it were a security? And then you're into the crowdfunding platforms, securitization platforms, trading exchanges like IPSX and another one I heard about at lunchtime, where people believe that we should be unitizing real estate and trading it as a liquid asset. Now, if we ever get to that point, then there's no reason at all why you wouldn't have ETF and index tracker property funds charging very low fees. And one intriguing question that fund managers should ask themselves, and some do, is what would happen if Amazon came into our market?
I think that's a great question. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about some of the things that you think are valuable in the market. For example, you said rental, social infrastructure. What do you see as really the hot trends and opportunities? Because we have undeniably a fast-changing and very challenging real estate market in the UK, especially. What do you see as the trends and opportunities, but also, I guess, the factors driving these?
See, that word trends interests me. Another one of my principles that I've not introduced yet is that I tell my students that they should never use the present tense in investment. In other words, you should never say the stock market is rising. Mm-hmm. You can say the stock market has risen, but that doesn't mean it will rise. So you should separate the past from the future, and the present doesn't really exist. So you never use the present tense in investment. So the word trends is a challenging, troubling concept for me.
Yeah,
it implies extrapolation, if you mean, of something that's been going on for a while. So if I were to extrapolate trends, I'd say that, well, the high street will shrink, logistics will be popular, and I'm not adding any value to anybody because we all know that already. You know, so in looking at future investment opportunities, often I'd go in the opposite direction. So I'd say opportunities are likely to lie in the retail market, the high street, places that are oversold. So I think right now retail parks are probably being oversold and they're a bit too cheap. Logistics, we think, is probably still okay, but it's going to go into overpricing at some point. I think offices have always been overpriced because people don't take account of depreciation, which really hits offices. Unless you time it really well, you're struggling. But I think there are some really interesting concepts going on right now. So, for example, co-working, I think, is changing the shape of a lot of office occupation. It's being focused on London right now and big markets, but I see no reason why every high street in the UK should not have co-working space. And it's just a question of who comes up with the brand that appeals to the working mother or whoever is stuck at home, you know, with parental duties, who can't afford to commute into London or Manchester and doesn't want to go home to work because where's the adrenaline, where's the spice? But there is a facility somewhere close to you where you can go and do something. And we haven't got that formula sorted out yet. I think that's going to happen. I think that residential formats are going to get interesting too. I think, you know, people are going to find the right secret sauce to develop affordable housing and private rental housing and make money out of it by appropriate management and clever financing schemes as well. So why not create a multi-unit resi development and sell units in the whole development to people rather than take a deposit for one flat? And they might be able to invest in the whole development with only 1% of the equity of their flat. So, you know, those sorts of schemes, I think, will sort of start to gather traction. And value add, you know, just value add generally. I think asset managers that are good at seeing a property that's got options embedded within it that they can then exploit by doing some value add work, I think they'll always do well.
Yeah. One of the things you talked about was kind of branding and marketing, which I guess I believe it has quite a big impact on anything that happens in the property market, is the brand and marketing. Whether it's you're comparing a Berkeley new build with some small developer down the road and they're comparable because of the brand, or anything else. I mean, a crowdfunding platform versus a more well-established, better branded crowdfunding platform. So if brand is important, then, and kind of can make a significant difference to pricing, do you not think that can and will affect the level of perfection in the market and the level of what I'm looking for?
You mean branded space, you know, so
space, anything, any business in the real estate market. I feel there's the opportunity to kind of change the dynamics in a market, and I don't feel it's sort of at all perfect or verging on it as a result of some of those things.
It's an interesting question. I mean, historically, it's been very difficult for anybody to make any money out of brand from the property market. So you don't see branded shopping centres typically. Westfield have been the exception. They to some extent broken that rule, but prior to Westfield, nobody really could get any brand value out of a shopping centre. The shopping centre's brand was Lakeside, not Hammerson or Lendlease. Office buildings, you know, I don't think anybody really chooses an office building because it's Heinz building.
It's only in the co-working spaces where there's an element of brand.
Yeah, so WeWork are clearly shaking that concept. And hotels have been... So the first use of brand for real estate was hotels, I think. I mean, somebody could probably go with a better example, but, you know, Marriott, clearly, Hilton are branding space. And WeWork are simply following that model on it.
It's in retail as well. I've always had a test. I mean, so as you know, I'm mostly focused on direct residential investment, or have done historically. And there's a huge difference between having a Waitrose versus a Londis in your local area on value, and that brand affects pricing, affects values in the market.
Yeah, sure.
Proximity to Waitrose is favorite metric of mine, no? But it really does have an effect and shakes up values.
Yeah, agreed.
So does that make the market less perfect?
Because brands can come and go. Okay. I mean, happy to.
Less efficient, I suppose, is probably the. But I'm at the completely different end of the market, so I see all of the inefficiencies on the ground. And take a very different perspective. Anyway.
What about the branding of an entire area?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it takes root and branch review to change that. A huge regeneration scheme and a lot of money, right?
But I've seen Hackney go from the Pits to the most fashionable area of London in 20 years. I don't know. You know, it was pretty obvious that Hackney was in a great place, you know, right next to the Bishopsgate, you know, Shoreditch and all that area was clearly... an anomaly, but the speed with which it's become fashionable is pretty remarkable. And I don't think that's been a branding exercise by anybody. I think that's just happened through location, which you know that the most important things in real estate are to do with that. So,
well, the three most important things are location, 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 right?
Somebody said that. Which technology does have some interesting things to offer, though, because I think you can probably use technology and science to identify areas that are closer to transport infrastructure and employment, travel to work times, that sort of thing, for the prices that are on offer, so that you can produce simple algorithms which compare those things together and will point to the cheap areas.
But one thing that we discussed, I think, before we started the recording as well, was that you can do all the calculations you like, but ultimately decision making is often emotional in investing or in buying a property if it's at home.
Definitely, yeah.
Creates a complication. It's certainly something we've seen recently in the market where, like you said, even if there is stuff that's overvalued or undervalued, the bigger driver is emotion and nerves around, for example, political uncertainty, or has been recently.
Which is why I wouldn't be in residential development to sell.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, analysing emotion is not my strong point.
So, are there any other ideas that other potential aspiring investors who are looking at their next opportunities can learn from your experience? Because I think one of the things that you have a lot of is experience of both, obviously we definitely do, across the academic perspective and real practical profitable opportunities. What can others learn from that they can use in their own investment career or activities?
I'm not sure that people can learn anything, really. I mean, I'd like to think that experience and study and hard work pay off, and I do believe that definitely. On the other hand, there are some people who've made a lot of money through being lucky or just taking risk, and the property market will always reward people who take a risk as it needs to, because, you know, high risk should deliver high return. It's not something that I've ever felt the need to get involved in, and of course, if you do take a lot of risk, you can lose a lot of money. So that's not my natural tendency. I like to build a steady, upward-drifting portfolio of stuff that's performing like an option portfolio where the downside's underwritten and the upside is pretty unlimited. And that's the way it sort of works for me.
Cool. So before we tie up, if people want to reach out or follow what you're up to through any of the business activities or academic, what's the best way for them to do that?
The Oxford Future of Real Estate Initiative.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you so much for joining me and sharing your insights. If anyone has any questions or feedback, and to be the first to hear about future episodes, it's The Return Podcast on Facebook, thereturnpodcast.com, the.return.podcast on Instagram. And if you've enjoyed or learned something from this episode, please leave a review wherever you get your podcasts, as this really helps us to reach more people. Thank you for joining, Andrew, and thank you for listening. Bye.